brother priests, reverend religious leaders and heroes in so many parts of the pro-life movement, brothers and sisters and dear friends. It's a real joy for me to be with you here tonight for this 2018 Moutier Care Gala Dinner to celebrate and prosper the life-saving and life-changing work being done by Moutier Care for so many women in need, for so many of their loved ones whose lives depend on them. Mathilde mentioned an email. The email was sent at 6:52 a.m. She woke up with this idea. January 2nd, 2013. She told me she was starting a new nonprofit to formalize her work helping women in crisis pregnancy to choose life and accompany them through their pregnancies, helping them to deal with any past or present issues that were impacting their attitudes about and capacities for motherhood and much more. She was thinking of that creative acronym like Madres Unidas en Jesús con Esperanza y Regocio. How would that have worked for the name? How many vote for Moutier Care? Or God respects and creates equally for grace, which is a little easier. I was on vacation at her family's tree farm in Alabama and had the ability to reply right away. I encouraged her to steer away from acronyms and toward a clear concept that encapsulated the work being done and gave her four suggestions. One was Moutier Care, from the Latin word for woman. Told her most might not recognize what it meant at first, but once they did, they would clearly understand its meaning and it would stick. For Catholics, it might also evoke St. John Paul II's and the Catholic Church's rich teachings on the dignity of women, her feminine genius, the beauty of motherhood contained in Mulieris Dignitatem. Mathilde wrote back 22 minutes later with her characteristic speed and enthusiasm, saying in capital letters, "Great recommendations. I'm taking Moutier. Moutier is phenomenal. Moutier is easy. I think the Latin name is cool. It rings well. And I can almost smell incense when I hear it." And then she finished emphatically, "You are the best." Little did I know that 1,936 days later, I would be here in Nashville rejoicing at how Mathilde, with the help of so many of you here, board members, benefactors, Knights of Columbus, Christians from all over Tennessee, parishioners of St. Philip, St. Luke, Assumption, St. Mary, and other Catholic churches, leaders of New Life Resources and Tennessee Right to Life, and others, have been able to take that idea with its cool and phenomenal name and build something truly beautiful, beneficial, timely, and now mobile and versatile. I'm really not surprised at how much progress has been made, because having known Mathilde now for over 20 years, I know she's a problem solver from a family of entrepreneurial Good Samaritans who see where needs are and respond with compassion, commitment, and great generosity. But I am surprised and honored to have been asked to give the remarks tonight, following in the line of my friends George Weigel and Raymond Arroyo these past 2 years. But I'm hoping that at the end of this night, Mathilde will be able to email me anew saying, "You are the best," as she copies Raymond Arroyo and George Weigel. Tonight, what I'd like to talk to you about are two extraordinary learning experiences I've had over the time that Moutier Care has been growing, both of which I think are relevant to the cause of the dignity of women and the sacredness of human life to which we are all so committed. The first experience is the privilege I have for the last almost 4 years to work for Pope Francis at the Holy See's Permanent Observer Mission to the United Nations in New York. There I've had the opportunity not only to see the state of the cause of life and the needs of women worldwide, but to participate in the Holy See's efforts to defend the dignity and genuine rights of both women and children in the context of many cultural currents that look at the maternal meaning of a woman's femininity with disdain, at unplanned pregnancies as cancers to be cured, and unwanted children as evils to be rejected and discarded. Many in the U.S. are surprised to discover that across the world, Only 30% of countries permit abortion on demand. Only 52% for rape and incest. 67% for women's physical or mental health. 6 countries don't permit abortion under any circumstances. Geographically, only 6% of governments in Africa and Oceania permit abortion on demand. 12% in Latin America and the Caribbean. This compared to 75% of governments in North America and Europe. The foundational human rights document, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which this year celebrates its 70th anniversary, very straightforwardly affirms right at its beginning articles that everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person. But since the early 1990s, there's been a concerted effort to undermine this genuine respect for life. In 1994, the United States government, led by Hillary Clinton, went to Cairo for a vigorous push at the International Conference on Population and Development to establish an international right to abortion. Thanks to the efforts of the Holy See's delegation, led by an American, Professor Marianne Glendon of Harvard Law School, and Holy See diplomats, it was largely rebuffed, only making note of preventing and managing unsafe abortion and providing services for safe abortion in places where it was already legal. In the almost quarter century since, however, there's been an unrelenting attempt by some developed nations to push abortion on other countries through trying to insert language into UN resolutions and international agreements everywhere possible, and through funding UN agencies and programs that promote abortion regardless of a total lack of a mandate. I'd like to focus on 3 tactics that are used because I think we can all learn valuable lessons from them. The first is in the use of euphemisms, sweet-sounding language to mask the reality of what's happening. Those promoting abortion will almost never refer internationally to abortion by name, but instead they'll talk about women's rights, the right to health, family planning, reproductive rights, sexual and reproductive health and reproductive rights, comprehensive sexuality education that includes unfettered access to contraception and abortion, and so on. Many Americans are well aware of similar language games and the use of words and phrases like choice or freedom of choice without describing what's being chosen, of describing the fetus or the embryo without any reference to the fact that this is a human fetus or a human embryo at the very stage of existence that each of us once were in our mother's welcoming womb. This points to something culturally very significant, that most supporters of abortion, internationally and nationally, are ashamed of it. They can't talk about it plainly. They have to cloak the ugly reality of what's happening in sugary circumlocutions. They implicitly recognize the truth of what's occurring and can't stomach it straight up, and don't believe others can either. Well, all of us need to continue to work very hard to counteract the feigned phrases that seek to facilitate the destruction of innocent human life. It's a sign of hope that even those most pushing abortion recognize the truth of the matter and the ugliness of what's being chosen. The pro-life movement in the United States has been a leader in counteracting these euphemisms, and we've been assisted by technology, like ultrasound machines, in which everyone, especially expectant mothers, are able to see the living humanity, the beating heart of the child growing within. 75% of women who see that beating heart choose life. That's why MoviaCare's mobile pregnancy help van, which you all assisted in getting on the road, is going to do so much good here in Nashville. The second thing we notice at the level of the international community is the economic and political bullying that's seeking to facilitate the spread of abortion. Pope Francis has called this process ideological colonization, meaning the attempt by powerful and wealthy donors to compel developing countries that were once militarily and economically colonized to accept secularized practices with regard to human life, sexuality, family, and even basic anthropology as a condition for the reception of development assistance. Pope Francis has even called this type of development extortion tantamount to a world war fought not with weapons, but with ideas. Progress, according to these developed nations, is defined for them in terms of ensuring women's rights, meaning access to abortion, or children's rights to education, meaning comprehensive sexuality education. In the last 20 years, there's been a massive shift in foreign aid budgets from various countries and UN agencies. Rather than giving to education, health, water supplies, and sanitation, and other needs, they give to population control programs. In the last 20 years, in Nigeria, for example, there has been more money given by certain countries of the EU, and during the last 8 years, prior to 2016, the United States, than all the money given for those four things that I just mentioned combined. Education, health, water, and sanitation. And the Africans are asking, why do you not want us being born? They know that when they look at official development assistance to other countries, like in Latin America, that population control programs are less than 10% of the budget. But why does it dwarf everything else far more than 50% in Africa? They know that this is a neo-eugenicism in which there are some who are wealthy and connected who just don't want more African babies. And they call it for the racism and the eugenicism that it is. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development's recent analysis of foreign aid to Africa as a whole has demonstrated precisely this, that more is being given for population control than for real human needs. And various UN agencies funded directly by the countries that favor abortion often intentionally misstate international law to try to pressure developing nations to adopt practices that violate their religious and cultural traditions as the price of admission into the modern world. What do we learn from that, from this here in the U.S.? We see once again the total lack of confidence in international supporters of abortion to propose their ideas to the developing world. Instead, they seek to impose those ideas because they don't believe that what's being offered, even supposedly for free, will be wanted and accepted. Developing nations are beginning to see that so much of their supposed help is being given with strings attached, and they're learning now to cut those strings. We know that a similar dynamic is happening in the U.S., when things are open to referenda and legislatures, in many places abortion is being restricted and pushes to extend abortion are being defeated. Instead, there's a reliance on judicial and executive fiats to defeat what people directly or through their representatives have determined. Well, this type of judicial usurpation and executive fiat from places like the Department of Health and Human Services under the Obama administration is frustrating for pro-lifers. It is, at the same time, a sign of positive cultural trends that those supporting abortion do not think that they can convince others of the strengths of their ideas, and hence that they need to coerce in order to get their way. The third observation I'll note is the need for continuous vigilance. The international level, those trying to extend abortion use every opportunity they can to establish a supposed fundamental right to abortion and to push for means for abortions to occur. A couple case studies are now happening at the United Nations with regard to the work on the global compacts for refugees and migrants, and then for all the work that the UN does in conflict situations across the globe. In both UN agencies, like the UN Population Fund, are seeking to establish access to abortion in these situations through things like what they call MISP, the Minimal Initial Services Package, in which everyone in these circumstances, in refugee camps, for example, would receive packets that contain not rations of food, but rather contraception and suction devices that can be used to perform abortions right there in the camps. Countries that vehemently deny that migrants should have any stated right to health care in their countries of transit or countries of destination insist that they do have one right to one particular form of euphemistically called health care, that they should have the access to free abortions. Just think about that for a second. No access to health care whatsoever if you end up as a refugee or migrant in their country, except you can get an abortion for free. Similarly, there are a number of treaty bodies that monitor the compliance of countries with the international agreements they have signed, humanitarian situations. Even though such treaties do not say a single word about abortion, but do not even employ any of the phrases that are used to imply abortion in international agreements. Provisions ensuring access to health care, period, or even the phrase right to life, is interpreted by so-called independent experts to include abortion in order to try to force them through international agreements. Had such treaties ever mentioned abortion or its associated phrases, these treaties would have never been ratified. But now the treaty bodies are finding in these treaties supposed rights that were obviously never there. What can we learn from this that can help us here in the U.S.? It's similarly important for us always to be vigilant, and not just about jurists and judges, for example, finding first rights to privacy and then to contraception and then to abortion, all linearly developed in documents like the U.S. Constitution, like international experts are inventing it within treaties. The real reason why we need to be ever vigilant is, as Pope Benedict once said, virtue needs to be won by every generation. We can't just rest on the laurels of those who have come before us. If we become complacent, if we think the battle has definitively been won, that's when things happen when we're asleep that can bring things dramatically otherwise. What's needed for us is a perpetual state of awareness, a constant desire not just to be alert defending against new assaults on life, but most importantly, to go on offense, to lay the groundwork for continued progress toward the truth, toward proposing the beauty of life, toward taking advantage of every opportunity we can to promote a culture of life where others never cease to push for what St. John Paul II called a culture of death. That brings me to the second great learning experience I've had in New York as Mulier Care has been growing and getting more established here in Nashville. Since my arrival, literally the first day, I've had the privilege to serve as the chaplain to the Sisters of Life in New York, celebrating Mass 6 days a week for the religious women of this 26-year-old community, founded by one of the greatest pro-life champions in the history of the U.S., John Cardinal O'Connor, to promote the dignity of every human life through prayer, fasting, and works of love. Among those works are meeting with women being tempted toward abortion, welcoming into their convent pregnant women with nowhere to turn, accompanying new moms with their multitude of needs, including often finding them jobs or safe places, helping women who have survived abortion find forgiveness and peace, training a vast army of co-workers to be effective laborers in the cause of life, working on college campuses to help young people make the right choices and grow as defenders of life. They feature a continuum of care for women in New York, Philadelphia, Toronto, Denver, and elsewhere that Mulier Care is seeking to do here in Nashville. Coming from a good Catholic home, I have been staunchly and always pro-life. I debated my high school English teachers and wiped the floor with them. I helped to found the pro-life club at Harvard as an undergraduate. I would regularly go and pray outside the abortion clinics in Boston and in Cranston, Rhode Island. I continued that service as a priest in Massachusetts, leading parishioners regularly to pray outside abortion clinics, taking young people each year to Washington, D.C. for the March for Life, doing all that we could to support the various Respect Life ministries. But as much as I have always been committed to helping pregnant women and their children, I've grown so much accompanying the Sisters of Life, for whom the sanctity of every human life is at the core of their charism and life. From them, I've been able to witness and practice what I would call a series of pro-life virtues, some of them very challenging, that I think are necessary for us to persevere in that perpetual vigilance and charity to which the cause of life and those sweet cries from the womb are summoning us. I'd like to share with you some of these virtues and good habits that I've learned from them. The first is a need to look at people in general and pregnant women in crisis situations in particular with a contemplative gaze that seeks to mirror the woman's inherent goodness back to her, no matter how broken or how messy her life might be at that moment. The Sisters of Life are inspired by something St. John Paul II wrote in his powerful 1995 encyclical in the Gospel of Life, where he said, "We need to foster, first of all, in ourselves and in others, a contemplative outlook. Such an outlook arises from faith in the God of life, who has created every individual wondrously made. It's the outlook of those who see in life its deeper meaning, who grasp its utter gratuitousness, its beauty, and its invitation to freedom and responsibility. It's the outlook of those who do not presume to take possession and own reality, but instead accept it as a gift, discovering in all things the reflection of the Creator and seeing in every person his living image." The sisters have told me that their dynamic with the women who come to see them is centered not on their own goodness, but in the goodness of the woman who has come, in whom the sisters delight, so that she can begin to see herself differently, so that she can recognize that they look at her as a beloved daughter of God. And this transformation that happens when she's able to see herself this way allows her to begin to see her child growing within differently, and not so much as a threat, but as a gift. This means, this contemplative gaze, that the way we approach the truth, for example, must be more than just the reality about the humanity of the child in the womb or what abortion is and does. It's also looking at the truth of the person's genuine goodness. The lie that someone feels a burden or worthless always plagues them. So often they need someone to affirm that inherent goodness. This look of reverence toward others is and must be at the heart of the entire pro-life movement. Because when we look at others, we're called to see in them the image of God. For those of us who are Christians, to see Jesus under the distressing disguise of those in need. The second habit flows from the first. It's the virtue of graciousness, an authentic warmth and respect that goes beyond mere hospitality, even southern hospitality. Our reverential glance is meant to overflow into reverential treatment. When we see God in others, we begin more easily to treat people with the piety and the love that they deserve. The third good habit is true listening. So many women in distress feel unlistened to, unheard, misunderstood, and unloved. As one spiritual writer recently wrote, "You can listen a person back to life. Rather than beginning with answers, When we begin by making an effort truly to hear another, to enter into that person's story, to express our sorrow at what has happened to that person, to know that what she endured must have been horrifying, women can begin to open up. "Yes, it was horrifying," they will often say. From that opening, you can open them up to love, to truth, even to God. To listen in this way, one has to surrender the desire to be in control, to have all the right answers, and learn how to trust in what God is doing and can do. The sisters tell me that so often women, after their first visit to their visitation ministry, pause at the door before they leave and they say, "Thank you, sister, for listening to me. Thank you for your time. Thank you for caring when no one else seems to care." Listening. To listen like this requires a fourth virtue, patience. Patience is needed to listen and listen and continue to listen, to wait on grace, to go at the person's pace, to take one step at a time and address one issue at a time when so many parts of the person's life may be out of alignment. But to spend that time communicates very clearly to the woman that she's important enough to wait for and can help her patiently adjust to her situation of pregnancy and to life as a mother, both short term and long term, with the patient she's going to need. Fifth is a merciful heart, as Matilda was talking about in the introduction earlier tonight. One that's really open to the sufferings of others. One who can weep with those who weep and share the joys with those who share the joys. Christ always looks with a compassionate heart in the crowds, and we're called to be his eyeballs, looking out with that same mercy. Sixth is the need for unity and community. So many pregnant women in distress feel isolated, alone, and abandoned, as if no one cares, as if they're never going to win, as if they have no chance in life to have a better lot. They sense that they're carrying enormous burdens all by themselves. They have a deep need for genuine compassion, to know that they're not alone, and that there's real hope for love, for communion, for carers. There's a similar need for those in the pro-life movement to experience this union and communion in order to persevere. In some places, there can be competition among pro-life centers, or among sidewalk counselors, or among pro-life politicians and others. This failure of union and communion weakens everyone and weakens what we hold dearest. The witness of a real loving communion among pro-life workers is, on the other hand, one of the most powerful messages of all for those who feel in isolation. They want to become part of that family. A crucial fruit of that life of union and communion is the seventh good habit, and there are only 82 more. No, I'm kidding. Which is the capacity for celebration. How important it is for us to celebrate when we have that grace. To live steeped in gratitude. To rejoice when others make the right choices. To share in good days. And even rejoice in the difficulties and sorrow, knowing that God's mercy can and will triumph even there. That he can bring good out of evil. Sometimes, though, we don't see the fruits of our work. And that's why for perseverance is really important to celebrate and celebrate well the ones we are aware of. What extraordinary joy it is to celebrate the baptisms of children whose mothers have been cared for by the Sisters of Life. So often the mothers ask one of the sisters to serve as a godmother after all the sisters have done to help that mother perseveringly choose life. But there are other so many beautiful episodes. A couple of the co-workers of the Sisters of Life told me something that happened during the recent 40 Days for Life in New York. Someone drove up and rolled down the window as they were praying across from the Planned Parenthood abortuary on Bleecker Street. When they rolled down the window, the co-workers didn't quite know whether they were about to be insulted by those in this verbal drive-by. But the man driving said, 27 years ago, I came by this clinic with my girlfriend as she was pregnant. I just now got off the phone with my daughter today, wishing her a happy birthday. He was thanking them for the gift of life brought about by similar pro-life witness and prayers a quarter of a century ago. And the co-worker celebrated that daughter's birthday with the grateful dad right there across from Planned Parenthood. The eighth gift flows from the celebration of the goodness of life. It's joy. True joy is contagious. St. Teresa of Calcutta used to call joy a net of love with which you catch souls. Joy catches not just one fish at a time, but whole schools of fish. In the midst of darkness, for those within interior or exterior storms, a smile, a grounded sense of humor, a holy cheerfulness can serve as a real lighthouse. This is key joy for the movement in general. There's obviously much that we could choose to complain about, from political figures who let us down, to the toxins that flow from Hollywood, to the lack of commitment of those who should be standing strongly at our side. But it's really important for us with that choice to make, to choose joy. Because life is good, life is beautiful, and God is with us, at our side, helping us, loving us, wanting us to have life to the full, filling us with His joy, and making us His channels to fill others with that same life and joy. Nine is courage. It requires real valor to get up every day and put oneself vulnerably out there. Sometimes those who have been in the pro-life movement can show signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. It takes courage to confront one's inadequacies and shortcomings. It takes audacity to reach out once more after one has been rejected and after one has had a litany of failures. It takes courage to persevere past thoughts of discouragement, to soldier on when one suspects he or she is being manipulated. When one becomes a target of those who accuse us because of our pro-life convictions and work, it's being opposed to women and their rights rather than their greatest lovers and defenders. This is especially the case for those with sensitive hearts. We need the courage to continue to love even when that love is unrequited or breaks our heart. While unity and community can help us to remain courageous, so that we too don't feel isolated in our struggles, there's one last virtue needed, our final good habit, last but not least, which is a vibrant prayer life. We can't do it long term without the help that comes from above. Our strength in the battlefield is rooted in spiritual strength, in the power of God who comes to our aid in our weakness to make us strong in bearing witness to Him, not just in general, but in His image, in the woman, and in her baby. Prayer reminds us that God is at work in us and in others. It reminds us that miracles are possible, and that sometimes when all human means fail, we should still not despair. Prayer enables us to act with peace, because it's in communion with God that we experience a peace that the world can't give or rob. A peace that we hope God can use us to share with others as He helps them along the journey from brokenness to grace to realize that there's a love far deeper than the deepest wounds. One of the most beautiful things I have the privilege to do with the Sisters of Life every morning is to pray during Mass for the women who are vulnerable. Every day when I arrive in the sacristy at 6:05 a.m., there's a list there of the women who they've talked to in the previous day who are in need of prayers. And we pray for them by name and for what Catholics is the most supreme form of prayer of all, what Jesus made in His own body and blood on Calvary. But then we also pray in gratitude to God so often for the women who have received God's help and chosen to persevere in the difficult choice of life. 10 virtues, 10 pro-life habits, 10 roots of the tree of the culture of life. We could, of course, name others, but these are all staples. I rejoice that these virtues are at the heart of Moulier Care. I rejoice that so many of you have them in abundance. And I pray that God will fill you and many others with them even more. May God bless you all. Thank you.